I have periods of, is this actually good enough? And then they're there to say, Karen, please don't give yourself a hard time. This is great work, but I have points where I can't see it.
Hey everyone, I'm Katie Traxton and welcome to Anatomy of an Agency, the podcast that lifts the lid on everything that happens in the talent industry. In this episode, we speak to Carolyn Mendelson, award-winning photographer. She's won Portrait of Britain 5 times and is a recognized speaker in the world of photography. I started by asking her how it felt to be on this year's International Women's Day's list of the greatest female photographers of all time.
Some of them are very famous, iconic women in history, and then a couple of us were more contemporary photographers. So maybe they were saying, you need to know who these, if you're a photographer or you're anyone, you need to know who these people are. I was pretty surprised that I was on the list. So it's incredibly flattering. I am realistic though. These lists are subjective, but amazing to kind of be there amidst all these incredible artists.
Do we believe that they chose 29 incredible artists and accidentally picked you? Or do you think maybe you're being quite humble?
I think they picked me and then...
So... They're like, well, we've got Carolyn. Can anyone think of anyone else?
Yes. I think it is possible that one of the selectors knew my work, so therefore I'm at the forefront of her kind of photographic knowledge. It was just a really pleasant kind of little gift.
So I reckon they select based on talent and output. And this brings me to the topic of conversation, which is having an agent. Because you're sitting there being like, oh, I don't know how they select. Oh, I happen to have appeared on this list, goodness me. Your agent would be there, should be there, standing on the rooftop saying, well, of course, Carolyn should be number one on the list. What are you saying? What do you think are the advantages and disadvantages to have not having had an agent on your side during your career?
I think I can choose where I go and what I do, but sometimes having an agent enables you not to have to deal with every single thing that you do when you have a commission or an exhibition or you want your work to get out there. So yes, I'm an artist and photographer, but in fact I'm a marketing person. I'm my own advocate. I'm a speaker, but I have to in some ways put myself out there. I might not always be comfortable with that, and I think having an agent enables people to just do what they're great at.
So why haven't you had one?
I think the kind of work I do, so I do lots of personal projects, I do specific commissions, a lot of agents deal with either contemporary art photographers or commercial photographers. I think if I did have an agent, then maybe I would be worried about having to go up for jobs that I didn't feel suitable for.
So in essence, that's not necessarily about having an agent or not, that's about being able to find the right agent.
Yes.
And would you be able to? And do you think, has your experience taught you that you were correct and the right agent wasn't out there? Or that it's just very hard to maybe find them?
I think it's a mixture really. In fact, I do communicate with artist representatives in an informal way, agents informally, and I might say, look, I've got this huge job coming up, I just need a bit of advice. And these individuals, generally women that I'm talking to, have been phenomenal and just really happily share the advice for me. So recently I was approached for quite an extraordinary job and I wasn't sure how to kind of deal with the response. So I spoke to this brilliant woman called Emily McBean, who's an art buyer. I kind of had a Zoom with her and she just kind of went through things with me. She went, you'll be brilliant. They need you. And so therefore for me, I realized I'd put together like a great pitch deck for them that I could talk about the work. And then that's all I needed to do. And then if they wanted to select me rather than another photographer, that was up to them, but I felt more equipped. So I think having an agent means that things like, you know, the rights to the work, all those things they have in hand. Whereas I have to look very carefully at the details of what do I need to provide for them? I can't give them the rights to my work, because a lot of them will want the total rights, the copyright. I can't do that, but how do I put it to them? So the agents have the right language, the right context, they know what they're doing, and they have your back.
You're enormously accomplished and successful now, but obviously at the start of your career, even if you have the same inherent skill and talent, you don't have the same experience. Can you take us back to then and kind of tell us how old you were, paint a picture of what it was like stepping out before you even knew what a pitch deck was? You just had an imagination.
So actually, I never intended on being a photographer. It was the one thing that I would say I really didn't want to do. I was born into a family of very keen photographers. I have two brothers and a sister, and every moment in our life was documented. So every moment in my life, I'd be eating food and a camera would be shoved in my face. And I found it really invasive. Going back in time to my family, there were some amazing professional photographers who did large format film, and I loved the work that I see. So I'm talking about work that goes to the 1800s and early 1900s,
wow.
The between the wars, and it's just amazing work, and I used to be really entranced by it. So, but I'm kind of really digressing. I'm trying to give you a picture. What I wanted to do was to be an actor from the age of six, after seeing, I think, something like The Sound of Music, when I realized it was a job that you could like be there, an orchestra would appear, you would sing a song, and I thought, that's a job. How cool is that? I don't want to be a bus driver, I want to be an actor. And at this
point,
they
were the two options.
I think, well, actually, a bus conductor at first, because
okay,
I think it was like one with an old-fashioned ticket machine.
Yeah.
I really liked that idea. But being an actor, I loved, and I had a huge, vivid imagination. So I lived in a world of my imagination. I was born in London, but we moved to Norfolk, and my parents said, there's no way you can be an actor. If you were talented, you'd have been spotted by now, which isn't great advice to give
someone. No, not exactly how it works.
But with me, it's the right advice, because what I did, so if somebody says, I can't do something, I'm like, I'm going to do it, and I'm going to prove them wrong. And I had, you know, in my head, were there like the Oscar ceremonies where I get my Oscar and they go, we're sorry, you were right. So, and I like practice my little match girl audition just in case a talent scout come to rural Norfolk.
Preparation.
Always. So I imagined I'd stand on a table in a cafe, I'd light a match and I would die. And luckily for the world, and my eight-year-old self, no talent scouts came to the cafes that I went to. But anyway, I was very driven, so I did train as an actor. I then did lots of performing. I did stand-up comedy. I did physical theatre. But it was never quite enough for me. I never felt I was as good as I wanted to be. And I wanted a more bigger creative vision. So I moved into directing, and I moved into filmmaking. And I started to be seen as a director, but also as an art film maker. It's so organic, though. I didn't train as a filmmaker. I just saw other people do it. I thought, I'll sit with them and I'll watch.
But there's still a lot of passion and willingness to let that passion take you wherever it goes.
Totally. I'm really driven, and I always saw myself as a creative person. All of it's about stories. My work now is about stories, and what happens is that my life changed. I've been kind of opening cities of culture up with film projections and all sorts, and my life changed and I couldn't do it anymore. My life changed because I had my oldest son, and I was a single parent. I'd take him around with me to editing suites, and then I met John, had Sam and Poppy in quick succession. I moved to Yorkshire, and it was like, hold on, I can't
try the cafes
this.
In Yorkshire.
Can you imagine?
See
they would
happens.
Love me. They would love me. And one day John gave me a camera, like a stills camera.
So how old were you at this point?
I was in my 30s, in my kind of early to mid 30s, and I picked the camera up. I didn't actually, I'm lying. I did not pick the camera up. I put the camera under my bed because I was so aghast that he would possibly think I could want to have a camera. And then one day I did I did. It's very ironic, isn't it?
I needed a box of matches.
Yes.
And a camera.
I did. Yeah. I picked the camera up one day and it was like having an epiphany. And I realised that I could tell a story in a single frame. I could use my camera in my own square meter. I didn't need to move around. And I was totally obsessed. I had like tiny babies and children at this point. So like every hour of my life was taken up with making work, with making really nice pictures, with playing with Photoshop. And then I entered a competition and I'd only been kind of taking portraits for like 6 months to a year. And it was this Channel 4 competition and Flickr, and it was like, we're finding the next digital photographers. And I thought, yeah, I'm gonna enter that. Maybe Hallmark Cards will be the judge. I was making these really graphic, beautiful, kind of lyrical, whimsical images, not anything like contemporary photography. And I entered, and then I got shortlisted to like the 300 out of 3,000. And I went, had to go to London for like a whole day. And then I was with people that were proper photographers. And I could only use my camera on auto. It was a bit mortifying. And then I had to be interviewed by the producers. I showed them my portfolio that I'd only just cobbled together. And I got through to the final 12 and I was really excited. And then I got a phone call. I had to go to have a psychological evaluation.
Right.
Because it was kind of a reality arts program. And then I got a phone call. And it was like, Carolyn, we're really delighted that we're going to have you on the programme. I thought I was going to throw up.
And you were like, must be an accident.
Well, I didn't even think that. I was horrified because I was really excited about the journey up to that point. And then suddenly I was horrified that I was going to be on television, that I was they were going to find out that I could only use auto on my camera. The world would know. But there is also, so number one, if people say no to me, then I do it anyway, and I do it. And number two, if I am terrified for whatever reason, I jump into the terror and the fear. Yeah. and sit in it. Anyway, so I did that. I was on this television series. And then after that, I thought, I need to learn how to use my camera properly. And I was really driven. So I get very obsessed and focused on what I'm doing. So I just was driven to making really compelling, powerful work. And also that I was really into kind of using the camera as a tool to find out about the world, to find out about people. And that I started to get commissions to do a lot of lifestyle work after a couple of years. And I remember thinking, and it was all flattering. I won a few competitions, but actually what I wanted to be was an artist, was to use my camera to really pull people in to the story, to really put the person at the center of their own story. And that's kind of how it's gone, really. And I feel really fortunate that I've kind of carved a niche for myself. It's not a big commercial niche, though I do sometimes get kind of commercial projects, but it's a niche where I feel it's, you know, it aligns with my values and what I'm interested in the world.
So I want to come back to that kind of division between the different types of commissions you can get and projects you can have. But throughout all of this, I can completely understand how one thing has led to another, and you know, that which can seem inconsequential is enormously consequential, and so your story evolves. And so maybe you couldn't have predicted it in order to go to an agent and say, this is where I want to be. However, there were lots of milestones that you narrated, even as a child, because children have agents, or even then going and doing drama, or in any of these guises, where you could reasonably have thought, I'd love to have someone who understands the business side of this by my side. Did it ever cross your mind?
Well, I had an agent when I was an actor.
Ah.
That felt different. So, but as I think, because I came into photography quite late, even though everything I did was visual, you know, I have a visual way of seeing the world. I love art, I love galleries, I love film. So I see the world in that way. I never thought about applying for an agent, and also because I think I was always using the camera to learn things. And maybe I was a bit scared. Maybe I was feeling, oh, I'll be put in a situation that I don't feel equipped for, even though having the agent often actually protects you from that, because they're not going to put you up for a job that they think you're unsuitable for.
I think there's a difference between the known, which is this person's qualified for this job, this person isn't qualified for this job. And as you kind of talk about, the unknown and that getting comfortable with being uncomfortable piece, where you might have said, am I qualified to go on this Channel 4 show? You clearly were, but it's a bit of a punt on both sides. And I definitely do believe that if somebody's got the will and, you know, can acquire the skill, it's worth stretching them, yeah.
I think so. I agree. Yeah, I was actually, what I really believe in, and if I'm doing a talk or I'm working with students or anyone that wants to enter this art world or photography world, I will always say, be open to failure, be open to doing your worst work, and jump into things that scare you, because that's the only way you'll grow as a person and as an artist. I was thinking, you know, just briefly thinking about having an agent, and yeah, it would be amazing to have an agent, but for me it would be because I do a lot of work independently, and because sometimes I wonder whether I'm any good. And sometimes it would be great to have somebody who kind of had
my back. Quashes the imposter syndrome.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I know it's kind of ridiculous, the imposter syndrome, but my imposter keeps me on my toes.
No, I think that's just a sign of humility.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
That's just being a decent person. But what I do wonder about is, in terms of these creative projects that kind of come from within you, I can only really imagine that an agent could support you in, as you say, reassuring you when you're looking at the unknown, or perhaps helping you with legalities or the commercial side of the deal, whether it's getting the funding for your project or whatever it might be. But on the corporate side of the work you do, to my mind, a really good agent could actually help a lot, because they could be the person not just advocating for your fees, but actually advocating for you retaining your creative authenticity while also meeting the commercial brief. How do you feel when you have to be that advocate for yourself, confronted with a brand that's probably quite mighty?
I'm really careful with those kind of briefs. I'm very honest, and you know, so when I'm responding to those briefs, I come up with a treatment, and that treatment is based on what I know I can do. I don't want to be promising things that I would not be able to deliver, because I'm not that kind of photographer. So then it's about having a conversation once I've responded. So I hear what they are wanting, I then respond, then we have another meeting. But, you know, I think in that respect, having an agent who can do a lot of that work for you would be really beneficial. Because sometimes I think, have I presented the right thing? Have I put too much in this? Have I got the legal stuff right? Are they going to tread on me? I've had jobs where I've made a portrait of hugely famous people, and then I've not looked at the small print, which has taken that right from me, and that portrait goes across the world and I get nothing.
Gosh.
And that is awful. You know, you feel used, really. Even though my name is on that portrait, it's quite upsetting. So having an agent would mean that wouldn't happen ever. Doesn't happen anymore, but
I think one of the benefits of being so enormously creatively driven and kind of compelled by your vision is that I can imagine you kind of can't do anything but stand up for what you want to put together. However, are you as good at standing up for your rights in terms of how you should be remunerated?
No. because sometimes I am. Sometimes I'll say, this is what my commercial rate is per hour. This is what it costs for post-processing. This is the kind of license I could give you. But that's only after I've talked to somebody who knows that world. So I couldn't have made it up. I've talked to a representative or an agent, and they've said, Carolyn, double your fee. Carolyn, do this. And I'll go, oh, really? Yeah, don't be ridiculous. You can't work for that amount. It has to be double that. You know, you have to value yourself. Do it. So, but it's a very different, there are a couple of worlds I tread in. So the commercial world and the art world. In the art world, you can be paid a pittance or you can become hugely successful, which is a really small percentage of people, and your prints can sell for lots of money, in which case you do need a gallery to represent you. Lots of things to think about. So yeah, you know, I think having an agent would be amazing, but also there's a bit of me that would also want to really explore the relationship I had, explore the kind of work I wanted to do, because it's kind of, I have an Achilles heel in that if people tell me what to do, I tend to react negatively. So it would be having like a symbiotic relationship where they really wanted to work with me, I really wanted to work with them, and that we could work to kind of empower each other's practices, I guess.
So yeah. For any prospective agents listening, they just need to perpetually double bluff you.
Yes.
So that you take the path.
Yeah,
they
don't do this, Karen.
Do. Yeah.
Don't charge that. I think it's, you know, all the agents I've spoken to have been so lovely, actually, and have been so helpful. And I felt grateful for that help. Also, they've been like, you deserve this. I think, you know, there are people that have trained to be photographers or worked in the media or had agents from the word go. And it's being kind of familiar with how you approach that world. Mm. You know, I've found myself in this world. I've worked incredibly hard, but it's always usually been on my terms.
Which doesn't always feel like hard work. Like the manifestation of it's hard work, but if you're doing something that you love.
No, actually, I'd say all of it is really hard work, but when it's something that I love.
Because of the emotional input?
No, it's because I'm working
input.
For hours and hours, and I give myself a really hard time. So I call upon my community of artist friends, photographers. When I've got work in, say, it might be in the Imperial War Museum, it might be in a gallery somewhere, and I'm really doubting whether my work, I have periods of, is this actually good enough? And then they're there to say, Carolyn, please don't give yourself a hard time. This is great work, but I have points where I can't see it. You know, when I was doing a particular project that we were both involved with, I was like so worried that what I was going to create wouldn't be good enough, because I want things to be brilliant. I am a real perfectionist, but also I want this to be raw and real. So that's a kind of complex thing.
Well, but I mean, relating to that project, your process was very robust. It might have had an organic quality to it because you were reacting to that which was happening, but you kind of didn't leave a stone unturned. So I have two final questions. One is, what about when you were doing TV work? Because you mentioned Channel 4, but that's not the only TV work you've done. Is there ever a sense when you're in that kind of big, quite dominating beast that is the media, where you're like, well, this is very different to my known world of photography, and actually it would be really good to have someone by my side here? Or did you navigate it relatively unscathed?
I think the TV and film world are, you know, they're complex beasts, but what I love about them is that there's a team and everybody knows how to do their job. And I love, and sometimes I'd be the talent in that team, sometimes I would be the director in that team, and I love that. I think I really miss having a team. So it's a really different kind of experience. I think there's inequalities in the media, big inequalities. Hopefully they're changing. But I always worked with really good teams. So, like in theatre as well, it's all teamwork. Everybody knows what they're doing. And I think that's what I miss. You know, I need a team.
My last question is, you know, I don't think, whatever you think, I'm going to sort of half answer on your behalf, that I don't think you would have ever wanted to do it any differently to the way you have, because everything has kind of turned out as a wonderful adventure. However, were one of your children or a protege that you had to come to you and say, you know, I'm stepping out into the great unknown, I want to be a photographer or be in the wider arts, would you recommend they do it your way, or would you recommend they try and find somebody on the business side to have their back?
So I mentor lots of really amazing artists and photographers. And obviously I have my own kids who are now becoming adults, who will refuse to do anything that I say. Sorry, I will stop laughing. But yeah, when I'm mentoring artists, and it doesn't matter what age they are, whether they're young, whether they're emerging, whether they're experienced, I talk about how to be prepared. So I take the role of the agent on in some ways, bizarrely. I think if they can get an agent, that's fantastic. But also, to have an agent means they need to have constant availability. So it depends what they're juggling in their worlds. So that's another issue. It'd be great to have agents who could take on people who had young families, who could, you know, work flexibly with people. But then I've also had jobs where I've turned a job down, and I'll just say it between you and me, it might be because I'm a bit scared of it.
Oh, don't worry, no one's listening.
Okay, sure. It might be because I think, oh, that's kind of bigger than me, but it's bigger than me in a way that I'm not sure about. Because I did say I'd jump into things that were bigger than me. And then I've said, oh, I'm really sorry, I can't be in Manchester that day, I'll be in London. And then tell other people what I've just turned down, and they'll go, how could you turn that down? And then suddenly the person who's commissioning will contact me, say, we've changed the date. And I'll go, okay. And then I have to, but if I actually had somebody repping me, they would like talk me through it, I think.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I think also to the point about constant availability, I'm not sure if that is necessary as much as setting very clear boundaries and parameters at the start, which can evolve, but evolve in a very conscious way between the two of you, and you discuss it, and you both know where you stand. It's just managing expectations like anything else in life.
Absolutely. And I think if the agent really wants to work with you, then they will do that. Hopefully.
It's a partnership.
Yeah.
You work for them and they work for you, and there should be that mutuality and the respect of who has the expertise in which domain.
It's interesting because, you know, though I don't have a formal agent, I have people that advocate for me. I have curators, I have experts who will put me forward for things. I think having an agent would make it more simple and less random.
Well, Carolyn, you know where to find me. Now, in this week's Legal Corner, it's time to ask a question about photography. We turned to Hugh James' partner, Mark Loosemore, and asked him, how do photography rights actually work?
Starting with who owns what, the photographer generally owns the copyright when they've taken a photo. If they've done it as an employee, then it's usually their employer, the business that they work for, that owns the copyright in that image. The subject, the talent who's in the photo, will generally still own moral rights in that photograph. So that's to protect themselves from being exploited in the way that they've appeared in the image. That's something they can't transfer, so they can waive those rights. And I suggest to anyone who's photographed, if they're asked to waive their moral rights, then they should get someone to look at the document for them, because that's obviously another level of sort of complication. The photographer can assign or transfer the copyright in the image to a third party, so you get these aggregators like Getty Image and others who collect ownership of copyright, and then they exploit those by licensing those out to third parties for use, you know, for example, brands and the like. Now, those third parties or the owners of the photograph, they can't use the image of the person in a commercial way. So they may be able to use it in an editorial way without the further consent of the person being photographed, but they can't use it commercially. In other words, to imply an endorsement by the person in the photo without express written consent from that person. Otherwise, you get into territory of you know, things like passing off. Is there a claim for passing off? Is there a claim for trademark infringement if the person has registered, say, their name as a trademark? You know, there's various legal rights of action that the person in the photograph might have. Okay, turning to the person in the photo, what can they do? Generally, they can't use the photo unless the, you know, unless there's a contract between them and the photographer under which the photographer has given them permission to use the photograph in various ways. And so it'll come down to what has been agreed between them, and is that clear? So if they're in any doubt, you know, they should try and get it in writing with the photographer and be very clear about whether the photographer has transferred copyright ownership to them, or if they haven't, what they've given them permission to do.
Okay, so I think I'm sort of clear. Let's just dig into some of those terms. So to start off with, moral rights is basically about your image being used in the context in which you intended it to be and not being affiliated with things that could damage your reputation.
Exactly. So let's give a simple example. If you ask someone to photograph you for your private purposes, for your personal purposes, for the family, then it would be a breach of your moral rights if that photographer then tried to use that photograph publicly without your approval, because you haven't intended the photograph to be used in that way. It's just for family purposes. So that's the probably the easiest example of moral rights. Another example is where you've got a right to object to the photograph being altered. And of course, there's numerous ways now on your iPhone or your, you know, on your device that a photograph can be altered. If that's done in a way that's derogatory or puts you in an unfavorable light, you've got the right to have that protected. That's part of your moral rights. You can object to that. And the photographer or the third party who's used your photo in that way could, you know, you could have a legal right of action against them.
And at what point, as someone in the public eye, do I have the right to say I should have approved that photograph before it should have gone out? Is it only if I've got a contract with someone? If someone snaps me on the street, can they do what they want with that?
No, they can't do what they want with that, because you've got moral rights in your, you know, what's called your performance, in your how you're portrayed. And so no, they can't just, you know, they can't just take that unless they've got the defence that it's just for editorial use. And even then, if they've taken a photograph of you on the street, they may well be able to have that defence of editorial use. If they've, you know, if they've gone onto your private land or someone else's private land without authority, without being approved, then, you know, it's very unlikely that they can just use that photograph. And obviously, you know, we have paparazzi, you know, and they get into those sort of areas of debate, and often it turns on, you know, quite fine margins of whether they're the right side of the law or the wrong side of the law.
And in terms of that line between editorial and commercial, so my understanding is editorial is basically you are using that image in a context in which you're not getting paid. It's for PR, it's in a newspaper, it's to support you appearing somewhere. You're not making money off the back of it. Commercial, you could be seen directly or indirectly to be making money from using someone else's image.
The photographer might be getting paid for the photograph, but it's you know, they may be relying on a public interest type defense to say, well, look, this is editorial, this is being used on the news or in a news publication, and therefore, you know, I took the photo of somebody on the street, you know, and therefore I'm entitled to sell it for editorial use. But what they wouldn't necessarily be allowed to do is to then you know, sell it for commercial use
on a billboard,
for example, on a billboard to advertise a product or to advertise a service. That they wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't be able to get away with that.
What does passing off mean?
Passing off is basically where it implies that it was effectively use of a trademark that isn't registered, or its use of other intellectual property in a way that hasn't been approved.
Oh, like when you get a Gucci handbag.
A Gucci handbag, yeah. Although, yeah, Gucci is probably almost certainly a registered trademark, so that would be a more, you know, more obviously an infringement of a registered trademark. But yeah, passing off implies to the public or to, you know, the people seeing that the person has given their approval for their image or their name to be used in connection with a product or service when actually they haven't.